This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 29th of October 2008, I introduced the second session of the General Theory Reading Group with a talk on the theme Two Theories of Employment. The talk is based on Chapter 1 of my book The Economics of Keynes, A New Guide to the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening. So, Book 1 of Keynes's General Theory and Two Theories of Employment. Book 1 is just 32 pages, and Chapter 1 is just one page. In only slightly less compressed form than my own five propositions set out on page 1 of my book, GT Book 1 stakes out in Chapter 2 the essence of Keynes's critique of the classical theory of employment, and in Chapter 3, the core of his replacement, the principle of effective demand. As Victoria Chick said 3 weeks ago, it's like scene one of a great play. The main characters are introduced, but much is only hinted at, and we don't really understand what's going on. The real villain is not unmasked until Chapter 17. In this talk, I'm going to restate the key elements of Book 1 in modern terms, and also use a few diagrams at some risk, since they always oversimplify. But my hope is that as you read or reread Book 1 yourself, you'll find my programme notes to the play of some use. What we have here is two contrasting theories of aggregate employment. As its title indicates, the general theory of employment, interest, and money is first and foremost a theory of employment. Employment here means wage labour, the hire of labour for a sum of money, and not merely occupation or self-employment. A theory of self-employment is rather different because there's no hiring decision. In an economy composed of self-employed farmers and artisans, the employment decision is simply a production decision. How much effort to exert to obtain goods other than leisure? A decision by a self-employed worker to produce for sale may involve money as the medium of exchange of his output for other goods. But money does not enter directly into the production process. Where an economy is based on employment, production requires the payment of a money wage. And this arrangement can be described as an entrepreneur or monetary production economy. Now, classical theory is essentially a theory of self-employment, in which, if prices are perfectly flexible, involuntary unemployment can arise only from frictional delays in the physical changeover from serving one market to another. In the classical theory, the level of self-employment is limited only by the supply of labour available at any given real wage, so that non-employment is either voluntary or frictional. In the monetary economy, by contrast, entrepreneurs alone and not workers sell to product markets. And entrepreneurs decide what and how to produce. Entrepreneurs and workers necessarily bargain over money wages and not real wages. The idea of real wage bargains is based on the self-employment model, and for it to be generally valid outside a corn model in which all output is homogeneous, all firms would have to be producer cooperatives in which labour was paid according to the sales value of its output. Now, this type of firm does exist in a few cases as a species of collective self-employment, along with skilled artisans from plumbers to barristers. But the main concern of the general theory is with employers and employees who put a price on labour time that must necessarily be arrived at independently of the value of the subsequent output to which the labour may give rise. In a cooperative or self-employed economy, given competitive product markets, the exertion of labour to produce saleable output will generate revenue. If the product price is low, the revenue may not be worth the effort, and leisure may be preferred. The difference between an economy of self-employed households in perfect competition and Robinson Crusoe lies only in the division of labour. In a monetary production economy, by contrast, labour cannot insist on being employed, even if its marginal product and real wage exceed the marginal utility of leisure. What Keynes calls the second classical postulate in chapter 2 is not in general a binding constraint. This is because entrepreneurial firms exist not to hire labour, but to make profit. By definition, wage labour does not make the hiring decision. And the primary purpose of the general theory is to explain how firms can find it unprofitable to employ labour, even though unemployed labour is available for hire at the going rate. The purpose of GT Chapter 2, then, is to refute the classical theory of employment and unemployment on both empirical and logical grounds. By classical theory, as Michael Ambrosi made clear last week, Keynes largely means Pigou's 1933 theory of unemployment. By reductio ad absurdum, Keynes demonstrates that the predictions of this theory do not accord with the observed response of workers to changes in real wages. Secondly, he challenges at root the assumption that bargains in money wages determine real wages, so that unemployment is claimed to be a matter of money wages. This second point leads to the core proposition that only at full employment does the real wage determine, or rather constrain, the level of employment, while in general, it's the level of employment that determines the real wage. The rest of the general theory, after Chapter 2, offers an alternative explanation of the level of employment, compatible with the possibility of involuntary unemployment, something that on Keynes's definition cannot logically exist in classical theory. Keynes's definition of involuntary unemployment in GT Chapter 2 is that men are involuntarily unemployed if, in the event of a small rise in the price of wage goods relative to the money wage, both the aggregate supply of labour willing to work for the current money wage and the aggregate demand for it at that wage would be greater than the existing volume of employment. Now, the reason for this convoluted definition is that it allows Keynes to identify his point of departure from the classical theory of employment on its own terms. The clearer definition of involuntary unemployment, on his terms, of inelastic employment, has to await the definition of effective demand in Chapter 3, which we haven't got to yet. And it's perhaps worth adding in parentheses, adding to the confusion, that modern macroeconomics has changed the meaning of the terms frictional and voluntary unemployment, So you need to read Keynes's definitions with care. In modern macro, frictional unemployment is associated with job search by heterogeneous workers, which would come under voluntary unemployment in the general theory. And what Keynes calls voluntary, meaning closed shops and things like that, is today denoted structural. There's no direct counterpart in modern macro to Marshallian frictional unemployment, which is a classical form of involuntary unemployment from which Keynes deliberately abstracts. So clearly these semantic problems add greatly to the confusion. In the classical theory, the real wage is determined by the bargains between employers and workers, and the real wage, in turn, determines the level of employment. In the general theory, the level of employment determines the real wage and has nothing directly to do with the bargains in terms of money wages between employers and workers taken in aggregate. In the classical theory, observed levels of unemployment reflect a real wage above the market clearing level. And the solution lies in wage reductions, increased labour market flexibility, and all the rest. In the general theory, observed levels of unemployment are associated with a real wage above the so-called market clearing level. But employers and workers cannot reduce the real wage simply by agreeing lower money wages. Keynes's definition that we have here of involuntary unemployment in classical terms is needed for an appeal to the facts of experience, a very simple offer of empirical evidence against the classical theory of unemployment. No econometrics involved. Leaving aside the question of how the real wage can be reduced, he drives the classical theory to its logical conclusion that if such a reduction takes place, the supply of available labour will fall below the amount actually employed before the reduction. This implies that all those now unemployed, though willing to work, will withdraw the offer of their labour in the event of even a small rise in the cost of living, which clearly seems a little absurd. This can be illustrated in a diagram plotting the real wage, omega, against the level of employment, n. Now the point n star dot omega star here represents the point of classical market clearing equilibrium given competitive supply and demand curves for labour. Unemployment exists in the classical account because obstacles to competition in the form of restrictions on the movement of labour, etc., shift the supply curve to the left from S to SU. This curve relates the amount of labour actually available to employers at any given real wage, which is less than the amount of labour that individual workers are willing to provide in aggregate. The point of unemployment equilibrium is given by N1 omega 1 here, and the level of unemployment is U1, which is the difference between those two. Okay. Note that at omega 1, the supply of labour is higher than at omega star. Okay. So Keynes's reductio ad absurdum runs as follows. Given the restricted supply and demand curves for labour, these two, assume the real wage is reduced from omega 1 to omega 2. This defines a point of classical disequilibrium, NC omega 2 here. and employment is rationed by supply. Okay. And demand exceeds supply by NK minus NC, which is this double-headed arrow. All right. Now, NC here is less than N1, this figure here, all right, which corresponds to the original real wage. So that some of the workers employed at this point, omega 1, N1, withdraw their services. And since employment is constrained by the supply side, this means so do all those who are unemployed at omega 1, all these guys, despite an excess demand for labour, which we see here. Is that making sense? Yeah. So we can now use the diagram to illustrate Keynes's definition of involuntary unemployment in classical terms. This time, we use the perfectly competitive supply curve, this one. At N1 omega 1, here, the labour market is in disequilibrium, with supply exceeding demand, and employment is rationed by demand, by the D line. U1, as before, is the level of unemployment. If now the real wage is reduced from omega 1 to omega 2, going through the same exercise, actual employment increases from N1 here to NK here. And unemployment reduces from U1, this line, to U2. As a result, partly of increased demand, this difference, and partly of reduced supply, that difference. Keynes is not suggesting that the reduction in the real wage causes the reduction in unemployment, but that the two are associated. His argument is that his definition of unemployment is in accordance with the facts of experience, while the classical definition leads to an absurd prediction. So the second aspect of GT Chapter 2 considers how changes in real wages come about. Up to this point, the argument has simply considered the empirical implications of such changes without inquiring into the adjustment mechanism. Keynes observes that the assumption that the real wage depends on the money wage bargains between employers and workers is not obviously true and appears to depend on the tacit assumption that the price level is determined independently by the quantity of money. But indeed, that assumption clashes with the classical view that money is neutral. The classical relationship between the real wage and the level of full employment makes the tacit assumption that all offers of wage labour at given product prices will be accepted and rewarded by the marginal revenue product of each class of labour. This abstraction from the determinants of the hiring decision assumes that a monetary production economy can be treated for these purposes as a self-employed or cooperative economy in which involuntary unemployment cannot exist. In equilibrium, what Keynes elsewhere calls the neutral economy behaves like a self-employed economy and exhibits Say's law, namely that an increase in production generates revenue at market prices and a corresponding increase in expenditure. Keynes's task is therefore to explain what determines the level of employment, if Say's law is not assumed automatically to hold in equilibrium? And if the possibility is admitted, in circumstances of perfect competition, of a difference between the demand prices for the products of each industry and the supply prices necessary to induce firms to hire sufficient labour to employ all the labour available at a given real wage. And this is the cue for GT Chapter 3, the principle of effective demand. Now, there are several major preconceptions which the modern reader must put aside in approaching GT Chapter 3, which I addressed in my first talk and in my five propositions. First, the principle of effective demand defines a system equilibrium in which factor markets may not clear, although all goods and asset markets do clear. Equilibrium is defined in terms of the decisions of employers, consumers, and investors, rather than of the owners of factor services, because the owners of factors, as such, do not make the hiring decisions in a monetary production economy. The principle of effective demand is a theory of short-period system equilibrium, which may converge to a long-period position, but only in the short-term sense of Keynes and not in the long-term sense of Marshall. Some of you may need to read my first talk to make sense of that. The classical reader must accept that it is legitimate for Keynes to define the point of effective demand not as a position of disequilibrium in relation to the classical general equilibrium, in which all parties make their preferred choices, but as a position of equilibrium both in the short and the long period, in which no party has both reason and power to change their position. There are other difficulties which arise in the interpretation of income, aggregate, and effective demand. The problem lies with the consensus of the past 70-odd years that the point of effective demand is an equilibrium in the sense of the fulfillment of expectations, illustrated by the traditional Keynesian cross. In fact, it's rather odd that this process is usually expressed using the so-called Swedish ex ante ex post analysis, when Keynes explicitly repudiated that approach. He did so in his 1937 lectures, which were not published until 1973. I quote, "For other economists, I find lay the whole emphasis and find the whole explanation in the differences between effective demand and income, and they're so convinced that this is the right course that they do not notice that in my treatment this is not so." So what does he mean? By the mid-1970s, when these words were published, the traditional Keynesian neoclassical synthesis was in disarray for other reasons. So perhaps it's not surprising that it's taken so long to realise the significance of this problem at its very core in the familiar Keynesian cross itself. I claim, by contrast, that in the general theory, the level of income, whether realised or expected, bears no simple relation to effective demand. And the equilibrium level of income, in the traditional Keynesian sense, is conceptually different from the point of effective demand. Income, aggregate, and effective demand are three entirely distinct and separate concepts. Income is linked to current output, and effective demand is linked through future output to current employment. Both are equilibrium values in the mechanical sense that I've defined in my previous talk, but the relation between them is subtle and indirect, as I hope to demonstrate. So picking up the earlier cue, the purpose of GT Chapter 3 is to explain how differences can exist in circumstances of perfect competition between the demand prices for the products of each industry and the supply prices necessary to induce firms to hire sufficient labour to employ all the labour available at a given real wage. The analytical framework is a direct extension of Marshall's supply and demand apparatus based on perfect competition and price flexibility for use at the macroeconomic level, or in other words, to analyse system equilibrium. The aggregate demand function, D, relates the total money income expected by industry as a whole to the total level of employment, N, where the direction of causation runs from employment to income. The aggregate supply function, Z, relates the total expected money income to the total level of employment, where the direction of causation runs from expected income to employment. The intersection of the aggregate demand and supply functions determines, as equilibrium values, the effective demand. Let's call it D star. And the level of employment, let's call it N star. So the point of effective demand can be illustrated by the intersection in this so-called Z diagram. The Z and D curves represent Keynes's aggregate supply and demand functions. But note that these bear no resemblance to the Bowdlerized versions that you'll find in PY space in textbooks. In this diagram, the horizontal axis is employment. The vertical is expected money income. Thus, the Z curve represents the expected income required to maximize the profits of entrepreneurs in their capacity as employers of labor at any given level of employment. The D curve is the income that entrepreneurs, in their capacity as dealers in goods, would expect to arise from expenditure on consumption and investment corresponding to any given level of employment. The actual income expected at any time is given by the intersection of the two curves, the effective demand. So it's then possible to plot, as an exercise in comparative statics, a further functional relation, I won't attempt to draw it, between the equilibrium values of effective demand D star and aggregate employment N star, such that N star equals big F D star. Each value corresponding to different states of the independent variables of his system, namely the three psychological factors, the propensity to consume, the schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital, and the schedule of liquidity preference, together with the quantity of money in the wage unit. Now this very simple relation, innocuous looking, between D star and N star, which he calls the employment function, is the backbone upon which the whole skeleton of the general theory is constructed. Book 2 articulates the definitions and concepts that we've anticipated in GT Chapter 3. Book 3 considers the propensity to consume, and Book 4 the determinants of the rate of investment, which together make up the aggregate demand function. Book 5 unpacks the aggregate supply function and considers the relationship between effective demand, money wages, and the price level. And Book 6 is basically the policy implications. The principle of effective demand is integrated with the Marshallian theory of value. And in moving from the consideration of the individual industry, as Marshall does, to industry as a whole, there is no suggestion by Keynes that supply and demand have ceased to determine the prices and quantities of each product. Apart from improvements such as the introduction of user cost to deal with the element of supply price attributable to the use of existing capital goods, Keynes's theory of value remains essentially that of Marshall and Pigou. However, the principle of effective demand solves the problem that supply and demand in each industry depend on the output of industry as a whole. And it brings precision to Marshall's claim that short period and long period expected prices, and not only the spot prices of a market period, can realistically be treated as determined by the equilibrium of supply and demand. So let's consider further how supply and demand might determine expected prices. Most production takes time, so that today's employment will result in final output of finished goods only at a later date, at the end of the production period for each kind of good. Marshall recognises that employment is based on short-term expected prices, so that his short-period supply and demand curves must strictly be understood as relating expected, not spot market prices, to quantities. Each day, firms must decide how much employment to offer today, based on their expectations of the market prices they will receive for the different kinds of final output that will emerge at the end of the various production periods. These expected prices may reflect, but they're logically quite different from the market prices which output finished today will fetch if sold in the spot market at once. Market prices which determine the value of today's income. Now, Keynes's effective demand relates directly to this Marshallian conception, and it's the expected present value of the future final output resulting from the employment that firms choose to offer today. Effective demand is called, accordingly, an expectation of income. Yet the expected income represented by effective demand does not correspond to the income expected on any one future day, but it's spread over a number of days. Now, this is not easy to follow, and it's not easy to illustrate by a diagram, although one might represent it by a system of vector equations set out in the appendix to my chapter one. It's certainly a lot more complicated than the Keynesian cross or even the Z diagram. However, this diagram is my current best effort. Imagine there's one production method which takes 5 days and is started up each day, so that there are five processes or assembly lines running in parallel at any time, say the construction of 5 log cabins. Each column is a day. Each row, a process. Each cell represents the value of the output corresponding to employment on a process for a day. The relative sizes of the cells doesn't matter. Now, finished log cabins are sold to consumers, and they're therefore defined as consumption goods. There's no investment here apart from work in progress, i.e. part completed log cabins. I'm using Keynes's symbols here, so A stands for sales of finished output, completed log cabins, and U stands for user cost, the value of work in progress depleted on the sale of finished output. So note that investment is the reverse of user cost, so that even though there's no separate category of capital goods, investment is taking place each day by additions to the work in progress. Thus, the minus sign in front of the U is doing double duty in this diagram. User cost has to be deducted from sales to arrive at income. A negative user cost is investment, the addition to work in progress. Okay, so the single column for day T represents the gross value of output on day T before allowing for the value of the work in progress embodied in log cabin number one, this one. So it's before allowing for the value of the work in progress embodied in log cabin number one, which is completed on day T. And the gross output is made up, or the value of the gross output, I should say, is made up from the money value of selling log cabin number one, A1T, together with the money value of the addition to the work in progress on log cabins 2 to 5 as we move down the column. Okay, so that's the gross output. Symbolically, you can write this column so. However, gross output's not important. What we need is income and effective demand. So income, or current output, on day T, current output, is given by the shaded area in the diagram, which represents the value added in completing log cabin number one after deducting the value already embodied in the work in progress on that cabin. And so this represents the value of consumption, i.e. one log cabin delivered to consumers, that's the row as a whole, together with the addition to the value of the work in progress on the other 4 cabins, being the value of investment. Again, in symbols, you can see that the difference between gross output and income is the user cost for the 4 previous days of process 1. However, effective demand is something else again. Effective demand on day T involves all the sales values, current and expected, the expected costs of future construction work, and the value of the work in progress to date. Symbolically, it looks like this. And graphically, returning to our diagram, it's represented by the entire grid, treating the user cost cells as positive or negative as appropriate. Now, I hope it's clear from the diagram, let alone the mathematical expressions, that the shapes of Y income and D star effective demand are quite different. Income and effective demand are not commensurable. And the Keynesian cross represents the point of effective demand only by changing its meaning entirely. The coherence of the Keynesian cross story depends on making the assumption of homogeneous output, so just one process, that underlies modern macro. As we saw last week, it was this assumption with which Pigou wrestled unsuccessfully, and which, as we shall see in later talks, is anathema to Keynes. Now, each cell in the diagram represents an equilibrium expected money value. And I have not yet explained how supply and demand can determine expected money values. My first objective here has been to establish that effective demand is not equilibrium income in the sense of the Keynesian cross. And it's probably quite unlike anything you were likely to have seen before. So when we come to the determination of expected prices by supply and demand, many have been puzzled by the definition of aggregate demand as the proceeds which entrepreneurs expect to receive from employment, page 25 of the GT, rather than in terms of the expenditure of consumers and investors, which is the aggregate demand of traditional Keynesian economics. Yet this paradox is already implicit in Marshall's claim that the prices expected by entrepreneurs today are determined by the equilibrium of supply and demand. My answer is that Keynes's entrepreneurs must be understood as fulfilling two separate functions on either side of the market, as employers of labour on the one hand, and as self-employed wholesale and retail dealers on the other. Employers are specialised in managing the risks of production, and dealers in managing the risks of marketing finished goods, which is a division of enterprise commonly observed in practice. In this construction, production takes place when an employer receives an order, usually from a dealer or another employer. Production to order implies, under perfect competition, the existence of a set of forward markets for each good that is producible today for delivery at the end of its production period. Competition between employers establishes a unique supply price for any given quantity. And competition between dealers, whatever their individual expectations about future spot prices, establishes a demand price at which each dealer's demand is in equilibrium. And if any speculation about future spot prices by employers is treated as a dealer activity, the equilibrium forward prices of current output become shared short-term expectations, price expectations, which permits unique definition of the state of expectation. So the point of effective demand turns out to be a short period equilibrium position, meaning that entrepreneurs as a whole adjust their employment of labour to maximise their expected profit with a given aggregate stock of capital goods. Since Keynes's short period corresponds to his day, previous lecture, and the day is the quantum unit of time, this means that aggregate demand and supply are in static equilibrium at all times, every day. The equilibrium process of finding the point of effective demand, which Keynes describes on page 25, takes place on a single day, the present day, not over time. The equilibrium price of the future output of each industry corresponding to today's aggregate employment, that equilibrium price is determined today as the price which clears the supply offers by employers and the demand bids by dealers in the forward market for delivery at the end of each production period for each kind of heterogeneous good. Each day, employment moves directly to the equilibrium position corresponding to the set of forward prices, so that within the quantum limit of the day as the unit of time, employment is in continuous equilibrium. The set of equilibrium expected prices that determines effective demand also corresponds to the state of short-term expectation, so that it can properly be said that expectation determines output and employment, determines output and employment, which is the title of GT Chapter 5, which we'll consider further in the next but one session. So to conclude, the classical theory describes an economy in which there is no wage labour in any genuine sense. The money wage is the distinctive feature of the entrepreneur or monetary production economy, in which workers must be paid today in money and not with a share of future output. The classical theory of employment can describe a self-employed or cooperative economy in which there is no decision to hire labour, only offers of labour, and involuntary unemployment in Keynes's carefully defined sense is impossible. Alternatively, it describes a neutral economy in which there exists no long-term option to abstain from either consumption or investment, and involuntary unemployment becomes part of disequilibrium business cycle theory. Next week, we'll hear from Claudio Sardoni on the connections between Keynes, Marx, and the general theory. I think it'll now be clear that the wage contract, so important to Marx's analysis, also plays a central role in Keynes's thought, albeit cloaked by the methodological individualism of Marshallian economics. Keynes criticizes the classical theory of employment on both empirical and logical grounds. Unemployed workers do not behave, as the theory predicts. And as a matter of logic, aggregate real wages cannot be determined by money wages. In order to replace the classical theory, Keynes extends Marshall's analysis of competitive supply and demand by introducing the principle of effective demand. The position of competitive equilibrium of a monetary production economy is the point of effective demand, and it does not automatically correspond to full employment. The distinctions between income, effective demand, and aggregate demand are of great importance and have been obscured by the traditional treatment represented by the Keynesian cross. The classical theory is a theory of full employment, appropriately defined, where the equilibrium level of employment is ultimately determined by endowment, technology, and preferences. The general theory puts forward a radically different conception of competitive equilibrium, which Keynes calls the principle of effective demand, in which aggregate employment is normally determined by demand in both the short and the long run. Keynes is not about rigidities. That is Pigou. Keynes requires us to adopt a completely new idea of system equilibrium appropriate to a monetary economy. If you can grasp that, we're on our way.